Yeah, this is crazy. This just never happens. I've talked to lawyers about it. I've talked to historians about it. I went and scoured Wikipedia and other places for it. I can't find another example anywhere where a prosecutor in the case takes the stand in the case that he's prosecuting himself. It just never happens. I mean, this case was really a circus.
Well, I'm here with my friend Joshua Swamidas. We've been friends for several years. And Joshua is a professor at Washington University in St. Louis. He is a practicing scientist. He's a practicing computational biologist, very good with genetics, and he has several research programs that are going. And he's also stood for the gospel in many ways. And we've been friends, like I said, and we have a lot of commonalities in many respects. We don't agree in everything, but Joshua, I'd like to ask you, first of all, do you believe in the physical resurrection of Jesus Christ?
Yeah, Jesus rose from the dead. He's risen, right?
Yes, he's risen. He's risen. And so you see, we have this commonality, even though we disagree in some areas of science but still we embrace this truth. And Joshua and I have prayed together. We've been together on several occasions. We've prayed together. We actually have a scriptural tradition that we enjoy praying on our knees together. If people aren't familiar with that, every position that people were in the Bible, they were always on their knees when they were praying, or else they had fallen on their face. There's one occasion where Solomon stood in the temple. And when he dedicated the temple in prayer, and there was another case when David was just overwhelmed, and he was just sitting on the ground in the temple when he was just overwhelmed with how good God had given him. But in every other case, when it talked about positionally, and even in the New Testament, they were on their knees. So that's actually a scriptural tradition that we have. But in any case, Joshua has actually written an article, and that's what spawned this meeting together. And this is an article about the Scopes trial, because the Scopes trial was in 1925, and this is the 100-year anniversary of this. And Joshua wrote an article for Christianity Today, clever title, Setting Our Scopes on Things Above. And when I read that article, I learned things about the Scopes trial that I had not known, because I had never really formally read about it. I had just heard about it. So I'm going to let Joshua tell us about that trial that was really quite an exciting thing. And this was sort of when evolution was on trial. Actually, the religious side won that court case, but the greater win was actually not for the traditional religious side. And I'll let Joshua take us through this, and he has lessons for us today. So I just want you to go through the trial, and also the lessons that you projected from that and how it affects today, and then I'll ask you a series of questions.
Yeah, sounds great. There's a lot to tell, because it's a crazy story about all the little details that happened, and it's worth just kind of laying some of the stage before we get to any sort of lesson from it. But this was from 100 years ago. So it was in 1925. So we're in 2025 now. It was 100 years ago that this all took place in Dayton, Tennessee, which isn't that far from me here in St. Louis. probably a little closer to me here, than it is to you in Texas. But that's where this happened. So we're really talking about history. And it was a courtroom case, about a law. It was called the Butler Act that had been passed that made it illegal in the state of Tennessee to teach human evolution in public schools. If that sounds familiar, well, that turns out to be something that people ended up kind of fighting about year after year for quite some time afterwards as well. There's still even debate about that today, about what we're actually allowed to put into the public school system and in science education. But this is really the first major legal battle about it. And the reason why I wrote this article is that we're coming up on the 100-year anniversary, the centennial anniversary of the trial. So what actually happened? Well, it's sometimes called the Scopes Monkey Trial. It was really about human evolution. And that, on the surface, is really what it was about. But there were so many other things going into the in the lead up and what happened afterwards and so on and so forth. The key part why this became so attractive and interesting to people wasn't really because of the overtly religious side of it, but because it coincided really with the Transatlantic Telegraph being there for the first time. And there was a really famous personality that got involved and engaged. Like the Butler Act in the first place was actually enacted because of advocacy by Williams Jennings Bryan. Williams Jennings Bryan was this really charismatic politician. He was called the boy orator. At this time, he was in his 60s, but he gotten famous when he was a lot younger for being a really excellent orator. And he ended up actually becoming a presidential candidate 3 times. There's not that many people who have done that. Donald Trump is one of them. But unlike Donald Trump, Williams Jennings Bryan was incredibly popular, was a candidate 3 times, but never was actually elected president. And some historians have said he's actually been the most influential American that was never elected president. In the years leading up to Scopes, he had been involved on some major public movements that had a huge impact. One of them was the women's suffrage movement, to give women the right to vote. Also the anti-war movement. So this is right after World War I, too, where World War I just felt like a totally senseless war that killed and destroyed so much. And so that was even one of the impetuses for giving a woman the right to vote.
Let me just interject here. So in many ways, he was quite progressive.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, for giving women the right to vote and being anti-war. This is the progressive stance.
Well, yeah, it's a little bit if we're hanging our categories of what's progressive or liberal and conservative on our current moment, It's very disorienting to go back and start reading from 100 years ago because their categories, their bundles were really different than ours. Okay. And so, yeah, he was he would consider himself he's definitely a religious conservative or a fundamentalist. But he's really concerned about women's suffrage, anti-war, but then also the temperance movement he was really involved in, which we would kind of categorize as more conservative, though even conservatives today wouldn't be for outlawing alcohol, right? The temperance was back in that time. This is like right in the post-war period. Yes. Is that he's part of the anti-war movement. They're part of the women's suffrage movement. Women get the right to vote. And then one of the first things they start to care about now, too, is, well, we need to actually really start dealing with all these vices in society that are causing harm to people. Even if they're doing so willingly, we shouldn't be allowing people to get drunk all the time. And, frankly, we don't even really need alcohol. So we're going to get rid of alcohol. So that was the temperance movement to disallow alcohol across the entire country. And then, that leads to it becoming this big criminal enterprise. And later on, it ends up, we end up kind of ending the temperance movement and allowing alcohol again. But that was decades later.
Right. So he wanted the women's right to vote, and he fought for that. He wanted to end the war, and then he was in favor of removing alcohol. If we look at it from our vantage point, from our viewpoint, that's sort of a mixed messaging from yeah. as you put it in our bundles.
Yeah, and that's okay. He doesn't have to fit our model. And in fact, a lot of times we construct these bundles because we're trying to oversimplify it in ways that maybe are favorable to us, right? If we can put everyone all in the same basket, all those crazy liberals over there or those crazy conservatives over there, and we don't have to think or listen to people as carefully then. Yeah. And so that was a pattern that's going on today. And maybe even more so today than it was in the past. So we have to be a bit careful of putting our labels back on this. I mean, he was also a Democrat. At that time, Democrats were the more conservative party in a lot of ways too. Yes. It's a little bit like a bizarre world. There's parts of it that make sense and we can have our opinions and ideas on, we're familiar with, but then parts of it, they're just doing things in a little bit of a different way than we were, and we were thinking about things.
All right. So take us back to this trial.
Yeah. So he's off all these victories. And so the next thing, so he's kind of given up in a lot of ways and being a politician and like going for elected office himself at this point. And he's really wanting to have a big impact on culture through this sort of legal advocacy. And really towards the end of his life, really the end of his life, the focus became evolution. And his idea was that when we're teaching people evolution, we're teaching people that they're just animals. And so this is going to erode basic realities about how we need to treat each other with dignity and worth. And he was really concerned about that. He was really concerned about some of the negative applications of the eugenics movement. He was concerned about how this was just a slippery slope, in his view, towards just really rejecting the fundamental claims of Christianity. And so he was a proud fundamentalist. He adopted that label too. Now, fundamentalist meant something different back then than it does now. So fundamentalists back then, it was just five things that were really core for them to really affirm. Things that Jim, I think you and I entirely affirm, right? What were they?
Yeah, we affirm. So I wrote those down from the article. It was inerrancy of Scripture, number one. Number two, virgin birth. Number three, atonement from sin via the death of Jesus. Number four, resurrection of Jesus. And number five, the historical reality of Jesus's miracles. So those were the five points of fundamentalism at the time that were codified at the time.
Yeah, and it was those are pretty core things, and it's worth wondering why are they focusing on those five things? And the reason why is that all five of those things were under threat at that time. People were actually claiming to be Christians. These were modernist Christianists. It started within the Presbyterian denomination, but it kind of spread beyond there, at least in the United States. It probably really began in Europe. But these modernist Christians really said, you know, yeah, we're Christians too, but we don't really think that the Bible is inerrant. It's full of errors. And Jesus wasn't really born of a virgin. And you know, he didn't really rise from the dead. And those miracle things, that's kind of an embarrassment. That's a backward sort of thinking. We really need to modernize our faith to kind of realize that those things didn't really happen. Mm-hmm. And so that was going on in the church at the time. And so it was very alarming to people that were calling themselves now fundamentalists, saying, hey, these are the five things that we really do think are core. We can disagree about a lot of other things, but this is actually something that's important to what it means to be a historical Christian. So Brian is worried about that. And so that's why he's really involved. And so he decides that you know, Tennessee really... Well, he wasn't just in Tennessee. He was advocating across the country to put laws in place that make it illegal to teach evolution in public schools. Now, it would have gone fine, except there ended up being a test case. It was put together by this guy named John T. Scopes. He kind of came forward at the behest of the ACLU, or the American Civil Liberties Union, saying, you know, I actually did teach it. So now what are you going to do?
Yeah, so Scopes was a high school teacher.
He's a high school teacher, right. Yeah, he's just a high school teacher. And it's not even really clear if he really did teach it or not. It was clearly, it had all the artificial nature of it being provoking it just to have a test case that we can go to law to test how illegal this really is. Okay. The actual fine was like only $500. Like $100. People actually kind of said, hey, volunteered to actually pay it for him, but the ACLU wanted to take it forward. And so the ACLU was really new at that time. Scopes trial ends up becoming really the first, court case that really they win and really makes them well known across the country. Before them, no one really knew who the ACLU was. And so, and what was kind of a debate here legally is whether or not the majority William Jen Bryan was a majoritarian populist, whether the majority really has the right to kind of violate the rights of individuals. And at that time, we didn't really have a robust view of civil rights or the idea of individual rights and how the government shouldn't violate that at the time. And that was really the key reason or the rationale behind the ACLU taking this up. They wanted to argue that actually that people have a right to academic freedom and to teach what they want to, and the government doesn't actually have the right to infringe upon that. And so they took this up and they decided to actually fund the defense entirely. And recognizing that they're going to be arguing against Williams, John, and Brian, they really looked around to figure out, well, what's the famous lawyer we could have kind of argue on our side too? And they invited a guy named Charles Darrow, who was a militant agnostic. He was very, very anti-Christian, but he wouldn't call himself an atheist. He was an agnostic. So Charles Darrow ends up being on the side of the defense with the ACOL defending John T. Scopes, and then Williams Jennings Bryan being on the prosecution with a team on him that are going to prosecute John T. Scopes for teaching evolution in the high school.
If you do not believe in the physical resurrection of Jesus Christ, send me an email, tour@drjamestour.org, and we will get together and I will share with you about why I embrace the resurrection of Jesus. What I found interesting from your article, it says that the ACLU's original strategy was to say that evolution was in fact compatible with the book of Genesis. Compatible. So in other words, they were saying this is okay with the book of Genesis, but the judge dismissed this out of hand, wouldn't let them take that position, which is actually the position now of many believers, including yourself, evolution is entirely compatible with Genesis. And that's what they wanted to first come at this with, correct?
Yeah, it's really remarkable when you actually look at this legal strategy, because they recognized at the time that, hey, the majority of people are religious. You know, there was jurors, almost certainly all of the jurors were Christians. And so and they weren't anti-Christian. I mean, there was definitely non-religious people associated with the ACLU, but they weren't anti-Christian. They weren't stupid. They realized if we just take an anti-Christian viewpoint and argue that as our own, we're going to lose. And so they didn't want to argue that. That wasn't really what they were trying. They weren't trying to argue against Christianity, but they were more saying, you know, they wanted to give a better way out. Like, okay, this is the way you could be a Christian and affirm it. And the judge said no. And the reason why he said no is that the actual text of the Butler Act, it says two things, really. One is it says you can't teach evolution. And then when it expands on it, it says you can't teach anything contrary to what the Bible teaches without actually mentioning evolution. And so it really becomes a bit vague. But the assumption of the people writing it was that evolution is in conflict with what the Bible says. And so And the judge didn't want to challenge that assumption. And so they just framed it that way. And the ACLU and Darrow even too wanted to really directly challenge this by calling Christians to the stage and to the stand that would say how there was no conflict between what the Bible said and how they understood the Bible and what evolution was teaching. But there was a catch, right? The catch was every single one of those Christians that they wanted to call to the stand to say that there was no conflict evolution wasn't a Christian that was like us, Jim, who affirmed those five fundamentals. They all denied it. They were all modernist Christians that denied the inerrancy of Scripture, the atonement of sin by the death of Jesus, and so on, and they denied the resurrection of Jesus. And of course, if you're going to deny all of those things, of course, there isn't really a conflict. I mean, it's just not, it's not really saying very much, right? And they were afraid that this would all get exposed, which it certainly would have been exposed by Williams Jennings Bryan when all these people were put on the stand. And so really, you know, I've talked to Ted Davis, who's an expert at this time. He just had a great book come out on fundamentalist modernist cartoons, which is pretty excellent, looking at what was going on in this debate between the fundamentalists and modernists. But at this time, it doesn't appear that there was any Christian that was identifiable that thought that Jesus rose from the dead and also thought that the evolution was true. There wasn't anyone really in that middle ground. That's something that really develops much, much later. So, you know, frankly, if I had a choice between those two, Jim, I think that I would hope, and I think I would have chosen to really believe that Jesus rose from the dead and reject evolution, if that's what the choice is, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And certainly a lot of the scientific evidence presented for evolution at the time wasn't that strong. A lot of it ended up being proven to be incorrect, or even frauds. Like, they presented the Piltdown Man, for example, as evidence for evolution, and that ends up being a total fraud. During the trial, they started to present evidence for evolution, and one of the pieces of evidence that was being offered pretty regularly then was something called Piltdown Man. It was a complete fraud. There was a person who basically took all these this jumble of other fossils, including like, a tooth from an extinct pig, and then kind of put it with other more modern human remains and kind of painted them and kind of claimed to have found them all in one spot when he didn't, and then kind of said, oh, this is Piltdown, man. This is like the missing link.
Oh, I see.
And respectable scientists kind of just swallowed that hoax whole and just thought it was all true. And at that time, people thought that. And creationists were saying, I don't know about that. Is that really the missing link? We're not sure. And it turns out that the creationists were correct. And of course, it takes many decades for people to figure that out. But that's examples of the sort of evidence that was being put forward for evolution at the time. And they weren't very good. They weren't really good evidence. I mean, that sort of evidence was never convincing to me. It's only much later on, evidence that's only been kind of really been put forward really in my lifetime, from DNA, that really started to be a lot more convincing to me. But they didn't have it back then. Mm-hmm. And so this gets debated about in the court. And in the court, too, they were so concerned, though, about all of these Christians that affirmed evolution as being exposed as modernists that don't believe that Jesus rose from the dead, they decided not to let any of them take the stand. They were completely infuriated by this and annoyed, completely frustrated by how this worked out. But in the end, they didn't want to take that view, which meant that they didn't want to actually have it laid out that clearly in court that, to actually affirm evolution, you're going to be one of these Christians that don't actually really believe that Jesus rose from the dead, because they realized that would be disastrous for mm-hmm. their case in the long run. So they didn't do that. And that's where the case really took a really interesting turn. So it's been going on for about a week. And what's interesting about this, too, is that there's really not a single substantive fact that's really at debate in the trial. No one actually contests that John T. Scopes actually taught evolution. And that would be in contradiction with the face value meaning of the law, if we're not going to be able to argue about this. And so the thoughts are is that this is going to really close really quickly. But in the very last minute, Charles Darrow, had been playing nice, taking the ACLU strategy through all this. But he talks to him and says, we're not even going to get a chance to present all of this stuff. So are you okay with me trying to call Williams Jennings Bryan to the stand?
Yeah. So think about this. This is Clarence Darrow. This is this defense attorney calling the other attorney, the prosecuting attorney, to take the stand.
Yeah, and I've talked to lawyers
and he agreed
about this.
To it.
Yeah, this is crazy. This just never happens. I've talked to lawyers about it. I've talked to historians about it. I went and scoured Wikipedia and other places for it. I can't find another example anywhere where a prosecutor a prosecutor in the case takes the stand in the case that he's prosecuting himself. It just never happens. Mm-hmm. This is, this case was really a circus. There was like hundreds of people there watching. There was hundreds of journalists there, and they were sending telegrams to Europe as covered across the entire country on a day-to-day basis.
And it's the summer in Tennessee. It's blazing hot. Everybody's in a tie. And everybody's sweating like crazy. At one point, they had to move out of the courtroom to some other covered area because it was too hot inside.
Yeah, and so this is the last day. The last day, they move outside, and there's like the stage is put there, and it's thought that, okay, the entire case is winding down. That's why they're going to have it outside. They didn't realize that that was actually going to be the beginning of the circus, and so it's going to be a gigantic stage for everyone to be kind of watching even as they passed by. But it was... The closest analogy to it, Jim, it might be like the O.J. Simpson trials from the 90s.
Okay, yeah.
Everyone was watching that on TV, right? Yes. It ended up becoming like this national phenomenon, even international. People were watching it. And, trials are happening all the time. But this time there was actually like a video camera right inside there. And we're watching things as it played out. Mm-hmm. And while there was really no major legal issues discovered back then, it was incredibly culturally significant. So that's mm-hmm. a lot of ways what happened, what was going on with the Scopes trial, is that people were following this on a daily basis in the newspapers. And there was radio shows based on it. And this was even going all the way into Europe, and people were talking back and forth about it. And this last day, people just kind of figured it was over. But that day, they basically, Charles Darrow surprised everyone. He surprised William Jennings Bryan, he surprises the judge, he surprised everyone except for his legal team by calling William Jennings Bryan to the stand. And Bryan could have said no and basically said, okay, I'll do it. I'm not afraid to answer any questions. And part of what's going on here is that he had been in this big public debate in newspapers trying to pin down Darrow and where he stood on all of these things. And Darrow was evasive as in answers. And so Bryan decided to kind of just to basically kind of put him to shame by being able to answer any question that Darrow was going to have for him. So on the condition that he'd be able to turn it around and kind of ask some questions of Darrow. And so he agreed. And the judge, I mean, it's highly irregular and it's completely weird, but the judge for some reason agrees. And then what ensued is like several hours of Darrow on this stage with hundreds of people watching, asking William Jennings Bryan all of these questions about what type of Christianity is, what he believes, most of which had nothing to do at all with the court. But it ends up being a complete circus of people really wanting to follow this. One of the most memorable questions he asked, which is really interesting when you read it, is he has a whole set of questions about whether or not he thinks that the 6 days of Genesis mean that the earth was created really young or not. Mm-hmm. And what's important about this is that William Jennings Bryan was an old earth creationist. He thought that the earth was really old. Actually, most Protestant Christians, most fundamentalists at the time thought the earth was really old.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
There was a big debate actually at the time between what the right way to interpret it was, but it wasn't between a young earth creationist and an old earth creationist. It was about whether or not it was long periods of days for each of those days, mm-hmm. kind of like how Hugh Ross would take it.
Yes.
Or if they were like shorter 24-hour days, but there was a big gap before them. So it was between gap creationism or okay. day age. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The gap theory.
And, yeah.
Yeah. And the long periods, six long periods.
Yeah. And so Jennings Bryan's kind of vacillated, but in that questioning, he was kind of more of a day ager. I'm personally more of a gap theorist. That makes, I think, the most sense to me, mm-hmm. Especially, you know, how I read Genesis 1 and 2. Mm-hmm. But there would be big public debates about that at the time. And these are all amongst people who were considered fundamentalists, literalists. Mm-hmm. You know, they're all kind of within that family of people that would have had all affirmed like the five fundamentals. Mm-hmm. But Darrow goes after this and he tries to make day age, you know, seem completely inconsistent and nonsensical. And, another really interesting component of it was, this line of questioning that Darrow has for Bryan about whether or not where Cain got his wife.
Yes.
And this is something that people have been wondering about for thousands of years, to be clear. And, you know, because scripture doesn't actually say explicitly where Cain got his wife.
Doesn't say explicitly. There were many, that he had other sons and daughters, that Adam and Eve had other, so that he would have had to have married his sister.
Yeah, yeah. So some people would say that, but then and that's technically possible, right? Yeah. And some people have a hard time with that, both because of our personal prejudice against marrying our own sister, but then also because there's like Levitical laws against that. And so
Levitical laws came thousands of years later.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just trying to say that. I'm just trying to frame the debate. So there's like people who would reject it on that basis. And so you could also wonder if God maybe created other people outside.
Yes.
And that's where he got it from. And so,
And that's kind of the view you would take.
That's the view I would take. Yeah. And it's been a point of speculation and debate for a really long time, long before evolution. But you can see Darrow trying to pin Bryan down on this, and Bryan doesn't want to get pinned down on it. He just basically pleads the fifth. I mean, it's not really technically pleading the fifth. He just says, I don't really know. There's a lot of mysteries in scripture. We don't really know. But he wants to pin him down to either say that, you know, that Cain was incestuous or there were people outside the garden. And if there's people outside the garden, you know exactly what he's going to do. He's like, why is it that you couldn't say that God created those other people through evolution? I mean, he wants to argue the genealogical Adam and Eve.
Because of you, millions of people have heard the gospel.
If you confess with your mouth Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that he's risen from the dead, and you will be saved.
That's right.
That's the requirement.
We talk about science concepts which draw people in.
Take these nanomachines and have them drill into cells.
This would be a great way to kill cancer, right?
We also talk about Jesus Christ, who's the best in everything.
My faith in Jesus Christ means more to me than anything.
If you could continue to give or give for the first time, we would certainly appreciate it.
You can go to jesusandscience.org.
Thank you so much.
But Brian is really resistant because he wants to have a view of all of this where evolution, there's really no space for it if you take the Bible script on face value. He's open to people outside the garden too, but he doesn't want to give Darrow an opening to argue for evolution here. So that's what's going on. So they're having this like cat and mouse game going back and forth. And, you know, Brian is at a total disadvantage because he is under oath and Darrow isn't. And he's able to ask the questions. He's not able to ask the questions. Darrow's able to ask the questions. He's not. But that's what happens actually over the course of that time.
And he's being pinned down on the first couple of chapters of the book of Genesis, which is very hard, you know, to interpret some of these things when you're being questioned in a court of law.
Yeah. Now, what's important here, too, to keep in mind is that none of this has to do with the actual trial. It has everything to do with convincing public opinion. Mm-hmm. And Brian is basically becoming the hero, frankly, for a lot of people, by being unashamed and unafraid to declare that he's one of those literalist fundamentalists that believes that Jesus rose from the dead and takes the Bible seriously without error, even though that makes him look like a fool. And then Darrow is arguing, you know, this guy is not all Christians. He's just one particular narrow, stupid, uninformed, backwards type of Christian. That's what those literalist fundamentalists are. That's what he's arguing. And he's making that case. And what's remarkable about this, and in a lot of ways, both of them succeed. So William Jennings Bryan really becomes, for a certain group of people, for the fundamentalists, the people like me and you who are watching, he really becomes the hero for us. And, you know, our forefathers, like our cultural, you know, parents at that time, they see him as really the hero of like legitimate historical Christianity. Uh-huh. Darrow, however, kind of ends up convincing just about everyone else that historical Christianity is backwards, uninformed, you know, not thoughtful, not handling questions well, and this backwards thing that's to be ridiculed more than anything else. That's what he ends up convincing just about everyone else. Mm-hmm. And so they end up both being successful.
But the court case is won by William Jennings Bryan. The prosecution wins the case, and Scopes is found guilty of violating this Butler Act.
Yeah, right? Yeah, he does.
So this is an important point because the prosecution won the case. There was a violation of the Butler Act. However, the much bigger win was for the defense, for Clarence Darrow, even though his man was fined or whatever it was. The much bigger win in public opinion over, maybe not immediately, but over the decades that followed, was actually for the defense, correct?
Yeah. So what happened is this is what ends up there ends up being a big split in the world that happens. More or less, there was a famous author that once said, you know, the world split in two in 1922 about, or thereabouts. Their fundamentalists end up really becoming very isolated. We kind of started our own institutions. Kind of in the aftermath of this is like, you know, when Westminster Seminary really gets formed, where Dallas Theological Seminary gets formed.
And the fundamentalists started moving away from the academic institutions and separating themselves from the academic institutions, which is the seeds of what you see today. There's very few fundamentalist Christians in mainline academia that are holding to these fundamentalist views. I mean, I'm here, you're there, but we're a small minority. I'm a small minority among my peers. And you see this, that was the beginning of it, right?
Yes, that was. Though we should put that caveat that right now, fundamentalist means something a little bit different than it did back then, right?
All right.
So fundamentalist now isn't just those five things. It's kind of come to be a lot more rigidity about a lot more things than just that. So we're not necessarily in that camp. We might be more considered more broadly like evangelical. So that's maybe a better...
Yeah, those who hold fundamentally to the resurrection of Jesus Christ...
That's probably what we mean.
This Romans 10:9 that we confess with our mouth that Jesus is Lord and believe in our heart that He's risen from the dead. These are the fundamentals that I'm talking about.
And yeah.
That we hold on to, and so maybe there is a portion of those still in academia today, but those who are willing to speak it forth is a very small number.
Well, it's gotten a lot better, I'll say, Jim. So it was really bad, I would say. So, I mean, the best place where I personally got to see it directly was like in the 90s. In the 90s, there was very, very few Christians in academia. But there were several efforts during that time. There's something called the Harvey Fellows. There's other, there's like things like the Veritas Forum, other groups that have really done a lot of work to try and increase the showing of Christians in these places. So now... it's better than it was, for example, in the 90s. Like,
well, I was a professor in the 90s. I saw it, but I was blissfully unaware of how poorly I was being received by people.
Yeah, so you would find Christians, but most of the time it would be modernist Christians in these places. So there'd be Christians that would like go to church, or maybe not. They would call themselves Christians, but they, at the very least, are different. They're not holding to these core beliefs about Jesus, and that's like a fundamental thing, right? And so it was a different type of Christianity than we're centered on. And it's gotten better, but yeah, it was for many generations, I think it's fair to say, there was this split that had happened where there was like kind of the Christian higher education world. Or the fundamentals higher education world, and then there was kind of a secular societies one.
And the fundamentalists started their own institutions at this time. They kind of separated, correct?
Yeah, that's right. They did. And to the point where a lot of people in mainstream society just kind of thought that the fundamentalists had died off. But
what's interesting, the fundamentalists won the court case.
Yeah, they did.
They won the court case, and when did... So you're not allowed to teach evolution in schools, but then when did this Butler Act get defeated? Because that's certainly what we're teaching in school.
Oh, yeah. So eventually it gets overturned on appeal. They wouldn't even do a court case with it. They just thought the whole thing was nonsense. The judge, I mean, it's a really interesting opinion to read, but that was like many years later that it gets overturned on appeal.
Okay.
And even then, even after it was illegal for several decades, people still didn't want to create controversy, so they just wouldn't teach evolution in high school. It wasn't really until after World War II when after World War II, there was a real push to modernize and kind of bring U.S. science education up to speed because how important it was in the war effort. Now we need to actually start teaching the best science that we have right now in biology and physics and all of them. And they started to put that back in. So there was like, so kind of temporarily for a couple decades, it kind of just kind of put a bucket of water over teaching evolution in a lot of places. But then it came back in the 40s. And at that point, this kind of is leading to into the 60s and so forth. There had already now become like a pretty big sea change where the majority of scientists now really affirmed evolution. And now there's a strong legal basis for individual rights. And so even then, now when creationists start to argue, they now start arguing on the basis of their individual right to academic freedom to teach it. Rather than to exclude evolution, it's now to say, I have a right to teach creationism. So it's switched. So by the time it reemerges, like in the 60s and 70s, like these court cases again, it's now being argued from a totally different script than it initially was. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
But
go ahead.
But I think what contributed to the mythic status of this case was a couple things. One of them was because, you know, for all the details of the legal argument, they're not that important now, but the cultural impact was profound. A week after the trial, Williams Jennings Bryan dies in his sleep. It's crazy. It's almost like you couldn't write a book better if you're just like making up like a fictional story. So he ends up taking this like mythical martyr status for some, and it becoming like an object lesson showing how fundamentalism had died for others. And so it ends up becoming profoundly symbolic.
So he gave his life for the fundamentalist cause.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Or it was the death of fundamentalism with Brian, depending on how you want to see it. So there's this group that are identifying with him and seeing him as a hero, right? And then the story gets retold. So in creationist circles, like William Jennings Bryan is a hero for all that he did to argue for this case in society. Like later on, I don't know if you remember the Dover trial from 20 years ago with intelligent design.
Oh yeah. My name was one of the names put forward as to one of these scientists embraces the, you know, creation that God makes.
Yeah, they put you at the center of the maelstrom for that. But yeah. The lawyer who's arguing for intelligent design there, he was talking about how he's going back and reading the Scopes trial and seeing himself as kind of completing William Jennings Bryan's work back then. If this ever comes up again this year, you can bet people will be thinking about that, the anniversary of this year. But I mean, even if not, that's kind of like that cultural touch point. That creationists see him as really a as like a hero. On the other hand, you have these people who kind of saw Brian as this backwards nincompoop that's kind of become. I mean, he was a smart guy. He was not backwards. This is just how Charles Darrow successfully misconstrued him.
Yes.
And associated not just with rejecting evolution, but also with affirming Jesus as risen from the dead and like polite, informed, knowledgeable society. We reject all those backwards beliefs. And so that view that Darrow had end up taking a hold and really becoming the dominant view in secular society and in all these places for so long.
Yeah. And in fact, it was that, what was the Dover trial? Was it 2004?
The Dover trial was 2005.
2005. You know,
80-year anniversary.
It was at that point that I actually saw a change in academia. You know, prior to that, you know, I had my beliefs and people left me alone. After that, people used that case and my having signed the dissent from Darwinism in the sense that the dissent just said that we do not view natural selection and random mutation as being sufficient to explain the diversity of life. Therefore, further research is warranted. That's all it says, that further research is warranted. We don't view these as having a sufficiency. But based on that, the exclusions started coming. We're not going to let you in this organization because you signed that statement. And my argument with them is that what is wrong with saying we need more research? That's sort of what academics always do. We always need more research. We will never cut out funding. But we always need more research. But it was on that basis they would say, we don't want you in these societies because you signed a statement without wholeheartedly embracing random mutation and natural selection, which you, Joshua, have told me is not the crux of the matter anymore. You've told me it's more universal common descent and neutral drift. Are really the arguments?
Yeah, it's a messy situation, and I'm sorry for how you were treated through all this. I hope you have always felt affirmed and accepted by me. I mean,
by you, you're the greatest. You're my hero.
Well, thanks. I mean, I was a nobody back then, but if I had had any role in any of those societies, I would have argued for them to handle it differently with you. But I think the problem was. It's a bit of a mixed bag with that. So when it comes to the actual statement, I actually agree with it. I don't think that random mutation and natural selection is sufficient to explain the diversity of life. In fact, I don't think most biologists think that it is. The problem is that people were taking that, affirming that statement as somehow an argument against mainstream biology and evolutionary biology. And then kind of using that as evidence, for example, in court cases, you see a lot of biologists think that evolution is, you know, it has major problems with it. Mm-hmm. And so, so that's kind of where it becomes a problem from, I mean, so I wouldn't have signed it, but not necessarily because I disagreed with it, but because I would have said that that's not actually a critique against mainstream biological science. Does that make sense, what I'm saying?
Yeah, and I think I've told you why I signed it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it came
to me. You got it in your email. You didn't even know
in an email. And, you know, you're plowing through emails, and it said, could you agree with this statement? I said, yeah, I agree with this statement. Further research is warranted. That was in around 2001 I signed that statement. I didn't know it would become the touchstone of the debate and change my life. Who knew?
Well, a lot of people signed it, Jim, and when they found out how it was being used, they asked to have their name taken off of it. So you weren't okay with that, which I'm not saying, I'm not criticizing or questioning that decision at all. So that's, I think, so I mean, the point is that just stripped of context, a lot of people actually had no problem signing it.
Yeah. But
it's only the later on context that created a problem.
And I went back after all this fiasco started hitting, I went back and I reread the statement and I said, I'm okay with that. I'm okay with that. You know, it's interesting. I'll tell this little story that I met with two of my colleagues. One of them was a Nobel Prize winner and the other was in the National Academy of Sciences. And they said they would never put me forward for the National Academy of Science. Now, I'm in the National Academy of Engineering, but I'm not in the National Academy of Science. And this was in 2006. And I said, you know, I've done as much as anybody getting into the Academy. And the Nobel Prize winner said, so this was not Rick Smalley, by the way. Rick Smalley died in 2005. This man said, no. It's not that you've done as much as anybody getting in. He said, Jim, you've done twice as much as anybody getting in, but you're never going to get in. And they would not put me forward because of my signing that statement. I said, do you know what the statement says? And I said, here, tell me what the statement says. Neither of them knew what the statement said. So I said, we're going to have another meeting. I want you guys to go back, read the statement, and then let's meet again. We met again, and one said to me, well, the statement was carefully crafted. I said, well, duh, what do you think? Do you think they're not going to have a carefully crafted statement? And it just argues for more research being done on this. And they said, well, you know, this is argued to get out evolution out of school. Look, I said, I don't know what it's argued for. I'm just saying that statement, if I'm going to be excluded because I signed that statement, the statement is innocuous. And they couldn't contest with that. And I said, on that basis, would you change your opinion here? And they both said, one said no, the other said, I'd have to think about it. And he never did.
Well, I'm sorry. I mean, I think I do agree that the statement in isolation is innocuous. I think what really weaponized it or polarized it or made it such a shibboleth was how it was being used in these sort of legal challenges. And honestly, I think in a lot of ways, there's some commonality here, right? So there's been a really huge focus at times by people in the ID and the creationist movement to get legal wins. But those legal wins, you know, you can win legally and lose people's hearts.
That's exactly what happened in the Scopes trial.
Yeah. And I think that's something I noticed because I was not a professor. I was a graduate student during the Scopes trial. And when not the Scopes, during the Dover trial.
Yeah.
and I observed that incredible shift too, where it went from people being kind of ambivalent or curious about Christians to completely hating us. And it was because of the Dover trial. And the Dover trial, we didn't even, you know, ID people didn't even win. They lost. And so they lost that, but there was this far bigger, painful loss that took decades to overcome of really just putting Christians and sciences in a huge, digging a really big hole for us that took many years to dig out of, I think. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, it makes sense. So just so the audience understands, so I'm a believer. I'm a believer in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. I have a lot of trouble understanding evolution, and very few biologists will discuss this with me because I ask them questions that they're probably not used to, that they'd rather not answer. But Joshua was one, was the only biologist in academia who reached out to me that says, I'm willing to share with you. And we actually got together, I think, what year was that? Maybe around 2015 or something like that?
Yeah, it was about then, yeah. About 10 years ago.
Yeah, about 10 years ago. And so I flew out to Washington University in St. Louis, and I spent a couple days. I ate in Joshua's home, and we went to the university. We got a room, and we discussed it, and we went through it. Now, I didn't leave convinced of his position because Joshua embraces evolution and feels that it's consistent with the book of Genesis, and he's actually written a book. It's
the genealogical Adam and Eve.
Genealogical Adam and Eve. And I've read that book, and we've actually done I think that was the first podcast that I did was with you. And when we talked about that book, and I think it's a very interesting twist on how you understand this. And I thought it was very well done. And so, but still he believes that Jesus Christ is Lord and that he's risen from the dead. So what do you do with this? So what he's shown is that it's very interesting what Paul has said in Romans 10:9. He says, this is what you need to do to be saved. You need to confess with your mouth Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that he's risen from the dead and you shall be saved. It doesn't say you've got to embrace the virgin birth. It doesn't say that you have to embrace a six literal 24-hour day creation. It's very specific. It's that Jesus is Lord and that he's risen from the dead. That's what it is. And many Christians will contest with me. I'll say this. It says in Romans, they said, well, you still have to embrace the virgin birth. I said, well, why didn't Paul argue for that? This is what he put forward. And some say that you have to embrace a literal 24-hour, six-day creation, 24 hours times six-day creation, or you've undermined the Bible, they will tell me. I said, look, Paul didn't argue that. He said, you do this and you will be saved. So we have this difference of opinion on other things. And as scientists, and we have this difference, and I'm open to evolution. It's just that I don't see the chemistry. I just don't see the chemistry. And I deal with molecules every day. This is sort of what I do as a business. And I think it's a hard stretch. I see this microevolution happen all the time. We have a whole bacterial program in my lab. We see this happen all the time. But the macro level changes, the large body plan changes, are harder for me to absorb. I want you to comment on that, and then I want to go down a different tack to ask you a few questions before we end. But go ahead, let you comment on what I just said.
Yeah, I mean, we can have those conversations about evolution, and there's going to be disagreements there, but I think the bigger things is, like, how can we be a witness in a world, in the scientific world, in the society at large, kind of in these moments, and what's going on right now in our current moment? So when we look at this, yeah, we can get sidetracked on the debates about the legal side or the scientific side. And I think that there's a place for that, and they can be important in times. But the more important thing is to actually confess that Jesus rose from the dead and to actually be a trustworthy witness of that. And our reputation as Christians matters towards that too. And so it did set back the gospel in that way when Darrow gets his win in characterizing Brian that way. It was a setback to the gospel as well when the Dover trial happened and that hole was dug for so many Christians, right? Mm-hmm. When we kind of yoke following Jesus to things that are not nearly as impressive as him, that does only damage to the gospel. It doesn't actually help in those cases. Mm-hmm. And I think we're at a point right now, there's a lot of political changes. There's a lot of cultural changes happening right now too. I think we do need to be cautious about what we are going to yoke or bundle the Christian faith with at this moment, because there could be a lot of long-term consequences if we bundle things in a way that isn't very helpful.
So when you say bundle things, do you mean when we take non-essential issues and say, this is important, this is an essential for Christianity? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, essential or tightly linked. Mm-hmm. So, like, if you talk to Brian, he wouldn't have said that, you know, if you affirm evolution, you're going to reject the virgin. I mean, you know, all these other things. He just said you're going to eventually do it. He would make like a very strong slippery slope argument, and he'd make very strong linkages. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I'd say in his context that was probably true. It's just not true in the broader context. I'm not the only Christian that is a fundamentalist in that sense of believing that Jesus really rose from the dead. The Bible's inerrant. I believe that, and I think that evolution is true. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of other Christians out there like me now. Yes, he didn't really know that. And it's important to recognize that because even if you think evolution is completely false, there's a lot of people in our world that are pretty convinced of it and are curious about Jesus. We don't want them to think that following Jesus means they have to reject evolution when that's just not true. We don't want to put that there as a stumbling block. Right.
And there's a verse in the Bible that talks about, you shall not add to my words. We're not to take away God's words, and we're not to add to his words.
Exactly.
And so God has a prescription for what it is that leads to salvation. And beyond that, we could really differ. I mean, we could be of different political parties. We can, you know, vote for different people. But you're my brother. And because we have this commonality of Jesus's lordship and his resurrection from the dead.
Yeah, so I think we can and we should talk about all those. Like, we've debated about the origin of life. And
like every time we're together.
That's the fun of it. It's kind of like arguing. Well, we're kind of, you have a bit of Indian in you too, right? It's kind of the fun of arguing around the dinner table.
I don't have it in me. By marriage, I do.
That's the fun of the family, is to be able to sit down and argue about things that are important. That's not to say these aren't important, but we're able to do it effectively because we are in family. Together, we're part of a common family. And so we can have those conversations and we should have them, but we should be very cautious about linking them too tightly to the core identity of the church and the core identity of the gospel. And that's happened over and over again in our history here. And we're at a moment where there's a real risk of that when you kind of think about how it's happening and playing out politically in places.
And the dinner in my home, when you were in my home for dinner, you've been in my home several times, but you were in my home for dinner with your wife and your son. You just had the one at the time. And then also there was Hugh Ross and his wife, Kathy, were there.
Yeah.
And I was there. And so you have, and so you and Hugh Ross differ on these sort of things as well. And you guys were having this conversation at the table, and Hugh would say some things, and you would say, well, that's not really the case. Da, da, da. And then he ends up, you know, you get in the car with him, and he drives you back to your hotel or wherever you were staying. And
and we become good friends, too. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, the thing about it is that we talk about disagreements. It's all about how you frame it, Jim, because do we have more disagreements or agreements? There's a set of things we disagree about. But there's also a lot of stuff that we agree about.
We agree a lot, yeah. And you know, and people sometimes they'll get upset with me why I have people, even on my YouTube channel, and interview them. I said, because, look, I interview people that I don't necessarily agree with them on certain topics, but I still interview them. I don't agree on everything with my own wife, but she's still my wife. I don't agree on everything with myself. Sometimes I say things and I'll walk away and think, do I really believe that? So, we're complex creatures. And plus, we have an evolution of our beliefs. Our beliefs evolve.
Yeah,
our interpretation of scripture evolves with time as we go on. We think about things differently as we go through decades of our life, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think if it was to proceed in kind of that very organic sort of way, it could be a very good thing. Except for we have this tendency to kind of create strong bundles that kind of last for a long period of time, where we assume that certain things just go together. And they're very particular. That's what happened during the Scopes trial, I think, with evolution and Christianity, or anti-evolution in Christianity.
All right, I want to ask you a couple of questions. You know, I had a whole list of questions. I'm not going to ask any of them, but I want to just finish this up. So if we have this separation of theology and science, you know, has separating science from theology led to moral failures in the past? I mean, what happens when you try to divorce these and you say that there's this sharp separation between us? What's the can science alone support human dignity, or is theology necessary there? This whole idea of we've been made in the image of God, and what happens if someone says, you know, we're just a bundle of molecules that are stuck together, and it was all by chance you happened to be here? What happens to science when you start separating it from the moral base that comes through a theological perspective?
I mean, it all depends what you mean. So I think in some ways science can work independent of theology, but if we're going to care about things as we should, like human rights and dignity and worth, science can't get us there. It can never be enough. I think the problem is if we try and separate science from theology and treat it as if science is the only thing that matters. If we can recognize that there's more to the world than just a scientific point of view, I don't think the danger is nearly as strong. I think ultimately science is one way of knowing, but there's other ways of knowing that are important too.
Yeah, but you know as well as I do, Joshua, many people have rejected a moralistic and theological perspective and said science does it, science explains everything. And I think that view is more common among the young, among undergraduates, among graduate students, and younger professors. But I think when they get a little bit older, they see that there's real places where science alone falls short. There's questions that science alone does not answer.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'd say it's not just that there are a couple narrow boundary cases where science doesn't answer it. I think some of the questions that most of the questions that we care about the most, science doesn't really answer. Mm-hmm. And so if you're going to be trying to build a science-only view of the world, you're going to end up coming up short on the things that matter most.
Let me link that back to this whole Scopes trial as Darwin had talked about quote-unquote civilized races replacing quote-unquote savage races. Do you think that this was the seeds, and we talked about this Scopes trial in 1925, and then it was around that time and that the Nazi movement started coming forth and talking about purity of race. How do you think that these things played together? How the Nazis may have taken the things that Darwin had said and said, we're just playing this out. I mean, this is just the natural evolution of humankind. These things can be dangerous. And then you put in the political element along with these scientific perceptions, and you lose the humanity of man, and it starts becoming a real problem. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, so there's definitely connections. I mean, if you look at Nazis specifically, they were omnivorous, kind of basically taking any sort of beliefs out there in science and even in Christianity and trying to find ways and repurpose them in ways that would serve them politically. So I don't think that evolution led to Nazism, but it's certainly true. They kind of cherry-picked ideas from evolution that they use. They also cherry-picked ideas from Christianity and from the Bible to use, and that's not a reason to reject Christianity or the Bible. When you look at Darwin himself, he didn't agree that other races were – I mean, he thought that the different races were not different species or even different subspecies because when people interbred across mm-hmm. races, that their children were fully fully fertile. And so there is this complicated story that's going on during this time. And also, you know, there's this question of eugenics that's kind of arising as well, too. As we're understanding, that wasn't so much about evolution as much about how we kind of learning how human inheritance was working. And of course, the Nazis kind of took that and they have their whole eugenic experiment that they're doing. But at the same time, you know, William Jennings Bryan and his wife were arguing for eugenics in the United States. But they meant it in a different way than the Nazis. Mm-hmm. For them, it was kind of more about how do we actually kind of think about how to be a bit more thoughtful and informed in how we think about, you know, reproduction in our context, not necessarily sterilizing people and everything that was going. And they weren't talking about an uber race. So there's a lot of complexity in this story. What we can see from it is that there is just this repeating tendency we have of taking things that are partially true in science and kind of adapting them and using them in really horrible ways to support our own interests.
Yes.
That is part of something that just demonstrates how we're really fallen.
And
I think you can blame those ideas that we're robbing from and cherry picking from, but I think really it comes down to how we are as people. We are fallen. We tend to do that really broken thing.
No, and I agree. I mean, the Nazis took from Martin Luther and some things that he had written about the Jews at the end of his life and took and grabbed that too. So when you're looking for something, you can find seeds of it in all sorts of different places. So you have two scientists here. We agree on the real important things, and we agree a lot more. We agree on a lot more things than we disagree on. And we have these disagreements, and we're still good friends. I mean, I still consider you a very close friend, and I've enjoyed this discussion. And I think that on this 100th anniversary of the Scopes trial and the 20th anniversary of the Dover trial. The 20th anniversary of the Dover trial. You know, there's some things for us to reflect back on, and some things that have probably would have been better had we not gotten into, and other things that have happened, and we've learned about our faith. You know, it's like our lives. I mean, we look back over our lives, and as I look back over my life, there's some things that I've done that I'm proud of, and there's other things that I've done and I wished I hadn't done. And you know, we have a whole composite of life, and God forgives us, and God carries us on, and it's just like working with our children. Sometimes our children do right, sometimes they do wrong, but they're still our children. They're still our children, and that never changes. And we love them, and we want to see the best for them going forward. Thank you for joining me today. If you could give us a like, share, or podcast review, we would appreciate it. If you have any questions, you could send them to ask@jesusandscience.org, and we'll try to answer some of those questions in an upcoming video. And if you do not believe in the physical resurrection of Jesus Christ, and you want to hear about why I believe, send me an email to tour@drjamestour.org, and we'll get together by Zoom, and I'll share with you why I embrace the resurrection of Jesus Christ.